Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Matsu Valley, radiofreepalmer.org. And all of our podcast episodes can be heard on mushingradio.com. Michelle Forto is here today. Michelle, how's it going?
It's going pretty good.
What is happening out there in the winter wonderland?
You know, it's not quite the winter wonderland that we'd like to be seeing at this time of year, is it?
It isn't. You know, I was reminded this morning by a Facebook friend that this could be one of those years where a lot of races are canceled due to lack of snow and lack of freeze-up.
You know, and it is cold, and we did get about a foot of snow at our place, and deeper into Willow, I've heard people got as much as 18 inches of snow, but I am hearing that the trails are punchy. And now that we've had a good little freeze-up after that one snowstorm, that they're hard, but they're punchy.
You know, we're in a kind of a weird time in mushing, at least at our place at our kennel in Willow. We're in between ATV training and sled training. And, of course, like many of mushers, we always have something going wrong with the snow machine.
Of course we do. That would be true. But what about those dogs out there, at least out here in the valley and in other parts of Alaska, that aren't sled dogs? How do you think they're faring with the snowy weather?
I think they're doing just fine. I think dogs acclimate very quickly to changes in temperature. We have a little dog in our kennel named Locke who has been inside for the last 6 weeks. Raising a litter of puppies, and then we put her back outside just the other day, and she's doing just fine out there by herself.
I think she's basking in the solitude.
That she is. So, again, we are about 5 weeks from when the official race season starts here in Alaska, official meaning the beginning of Iditarod qualifiers. There are a couple of races in December, including the Alaska Excursions 120, the Top of the World 350, and the Aurora 50-50, which is more of a sprint race. But the official start of the mushing season in terms of races up here starts the first weekend of January 2014 with the Connect 200, and that race has had a little bit of a interesting history the last few years with having to cancel for lack of snow. I know they had to cancel it last year.
They did. And, you know, I hope that we do get a good base and the Connect 200 can kick us off as it usually does every year. And, you know, a lot of people had a lot to say about when races should or shouldn't be ran. I know with my race, the Independence Mine 200, that was one of the hot topics, wasn't it?
It was. They all wanted an earlier season race, and in December in particular. And just thinking about it right now, it would be tough to pull off a race at this time of year with what we have right now. What is it, the 8th or 9th of
it's
November?
It's the
13th. Oh, it's the 13th. See, I'm losing days already. So we're in mid-November and have very little snow here in Alaska. But, you know, down south, I guess they've gotten a little bit of snow. What do you think?
You know, in Colorado, where we're from, they have had some significant snowfall. And it's just one of those odd years, no pun intended. But the snow is skipping over us at this point, but, you know, I could be jinxing us. We could be in for a couple of blizzards right off the bat.
So we usually skip a week after the Connect 200, and then the second weekend, I guess it's the 18th and 19th of January, is the Copper Basin 300, what they call the toughest 300 miles in Alaska. It's the second, I guess that would be the third weekend of January. I guess January has 5 weekends, so that would be the Copper Basin 300. The following weekend is the Northern Lights 300. It runs on some of the same similar trails as the Connect 200. It's the second big race here in the valley.
You know, and again, they've had some trouble in the past as well with enough snow, but bad weather conditions causing for some overflow and then some rapidly dropping temperatures.
And then the following weekend is the start of the Yukon Quest, the other 1,000-mile race that everybody talks about. And the same weekend is the Yukon Quest 300, which is the first 300 miles of the Yukon Quest starting this year from Fairbanks. So the Yukon Quest will run from Fairbanks to Whitehorse, and then the Yukon Quest will run from Fairbanks to Circle, then to Central, then back.
That'd be the Yukon Quest 300.
The Yukon Quest 300, and that same weekend is the Tustamina 200 and the Tustamina 100. So all of those are either Iditarod qualifiers or in the instance of the Yukon Quest 1000.
And does that round us out for January?
That would round us out for January. I know that they have gotten a little bit of snow down in the Kenai, and they're doing very well in terms of getting the race ready down at the Tustamina.
Absolutely, and you know, I'm just hoping that we do end up with more snow very quickly.
We do. So right after the Yukon Quest, we skip a couple of weeks there and we head into the junior races, first starting off on the 7th and the 8th and 9th of February. It is the Willow Junior 100. That, again, we're hoping for that big dump, big base beforehand to get those trails ready for the kiddos and the Willow Junior 100.
Right, and absolutely we're hoping for a nice good dump so that they can get a good base down for the kids, but also because that is part of the trails for my race as well at the end of the season. And as we all know, a lot of training goes on those trails.
One race that we did forget was the Cusco 300, which is out in western Alaska. That happens on the same weekend as the Copper Basin, the third weekend of January. So that will take place as well. I have no idea what the conditions are right there, but I have seen Mike Williams Sr., a perennial Iditarod musher. He has been training quite a bit out in that part of the country.
You know, I've also heard that the Denali Highway is a real great place to go do some training. They've gotten a significant base up in that region, Cantwell area.
Speaking of Denali Highway, we do have the Denali Doubles, which is a very interesting race. It happens the weekend of the Willow Junior 100, the 7th, 8th, and 9th. That's an interesting race in that two mushers mush together on tag sleds, and the musher and back, from my understanding of the rules, they're just there for the ride along. They cannot assist the mushers in any way. So that's a very interesting race.
I don't know. I'm kind of intrigued by the Denali Doubles, and I'd like to learn more about that race.
That race is only just a few years old, and I believe it's about 150 miles. I don't know a whole lot about it by myself, but I know that it is a very interesting race and becoming very popular. A lot of big names are running that this year.
Yeah.
So after the Willow Junior 100 Denali Doubles race is the Junior Iditarod, again on very same trails as the Connect 200, the Northern Lights race, the Aurora 5050, the Alaska Excursions. All of those races are on pretty much the same trails in the Point McKenzie Connect area. So we have the Junior Iditarod starting, what is that, the 27th, 28th, I believe, of February?
I think so.
Whatever that weekend is there, the third weekend of February, not the President's Day weekend, but the following weekend is the Willow Junior 100. It's about 150, 160 miles from Kinnick Lake there in Kinnick, the historic Kinnick Lake, and then it travels along the rivers there to Yetna, then on to Eagle Song Lodge, and then finishes up in Willow. Very interesting race. And we're looking for entries for that. I understand there's just one entry so far for that.
Yes, and that one entry would be our daughter. We're very proud of her for taking the initiative to head out and do that race this year.
So that is the third weekend of February. Then we have Iditarod Week, the following Monday, where the chaos and the circus of Iditarod starts, starting with the vet checks and all that goes along with it, the seminars and the teacher on the trail talks and the vet checks and all of that leads up to Thursday evening. Thursday evening is the big Mushers Draw banquet there. Big festive event. If you've never been there, it's something you got to check out if you're coming up for Iditarod.
That's right. And, you know, basically the last week of February into the first week of March is a lot of fun down in Anchorage with the Fur Rondi and
The Fur Rondi Championship race is down there, which is the same weekend as the, I believe it's the same weekend as the Willow, the Junior Iditarod. It's that first weekend of the Rondi.
I believe so.
So after that, we do have the start of the Iditarod, the first weekend in March, and it's going to take us, about 9 or 10 days or so before they finish up in Nome. And then we do have the Independence Mine 200, and we also have the Two Rivers 200 and a smattering of other races there in early to mid-March, including the Goose Bay 150, which is a very interesting race, very small race, very similar to the Independence Mine in terms of how it's set up and ran. And then to finish out the year is the Kobuk 440 in mid-April, and then we're back to the bliss of summer. What do you think about that?
Well, not really quite the bliss of summer. We had snow up until, the last week of May.
We did. So today we're going to talk a little bit about something that that people are asking about. Maybe it's self-promotion. I don't know. I don't have any problems with talking about what we do because we're at least trying to educate the public and we have the mic to do it. So I don't know if it's right or wrong. But let's talk a little bit about A Musher's Dream, Team Aneke, our book that was just published just the other day. What can you tell us about that, Michelle?
Oh, that book has been in the works for a few years and came to fruition just this last month. And it's a children's book. Talks about not through a dog, but it's about dogs and how dogs and humans come together for the same goal.
That is, and that's to chase that crazy Iditarod dream that so many of us are chasing. You know, what I found interesting, Michelle, and we'll get your take on it, was just the process of writing the book. I know we started talking to the publisher and the editor and the illustrator almost a year ago when you and I sat down and we decided to write our little story. It is such a long process to get it from your initial idea to that final book in your hand day, isn't it?
It is. You know, I started it on a piece of notebook paper that I borrowed from our daughter and, a few little colored pencil drawings, stick figures as they were, in 2011. So it's taken us a while to get it to where it is today.
So what do you think about the process of writing the book, you know, all of that it entailed, you know, following the progress and getting the illustrations and getting what they call the blue line and waiting anticipatory wait that we had for so long. When are the books going to be here? How do you think that process went and how did you feel about it?
You know, I think our dear friend Dorothy Wills Rafferty really made it streamlined and painless. Getting published today isn't what it used to be. There are so many people out there that self-publish and do it through the Kindle applications and Amazon, and bookstores are falling to the wayside. And honestly, I wrote the children's book because we could have done this as an adult book. We could have done the whole novel-type book. And we chose to do the children's book because, you know, I still like the feel and the smell and the sound of a book.
I did, too. And you know what I found so much fun in doing it was working with the illustrator and seeing her take our little idea from our story and really capture the personality of our dogs and how that they look and act and how they intermingle with us and how they're a part of our family. I think that's what really captured my point of it is just how the pictures tell the story in itself.
You know, and I was absolutely amazed by the illustrator and her name just
Barbara
escaped
Slocum.
Me. Thank you, Barbara Slocum. I was amazed because we're in Alaska and she's in New York. And we have never sat down at the same table and shared a cup of coffee and shared stories about our dogs. It was all done via email and Skype phone calls, and that's it. And she captured the essence of who we are as well as who our dogs are.
And it's truly about the dogs, isn't it? We don't even have faces in the book, do we?
We're not supposed to.
We are wearing a couple of pair of cool Oakleys.
Yeah, but we're not supposed to have faces. That takes away from the imagination.
It does. And
we don't have faces on radio.
As Hugh Ness says, mushing should be and will be all about the dog.
That's right.
So now that the book is published, what do you think people are saying about it? How do you think it's being perceived here? It's only been out 3.5 weeks or so. We've sold quite a few already. What do you think?
I think people... The feedback that I'm getting is from people that are already fans of ours and will support us through anything, and I'm not just talking about family. But everybody seems to be thinking that the book is fabulous. They love the illustrations. They love the little storyline. And, you know, like our Facebook friend G-Paw says, it is for every age.
It is. And you know what's interesting is I know going into it we didn't think we're going to sell a truckload of books and make a lot of money off of it. We're pretty much just breaking even on the cost that, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. You have to secure your ISBN and have to register it with the Library of Congress, and you have to pay the illustrator and all of these other things in order to get this 13 through 15 page book in your hands. It's not a money-making proposition, is it?
No, that's what I was referring to when I said that it's different than it used to be. I mean, we did it the old-fashioned way. We went through a publisher and, you know, like the process you just named. But I know a lot of people, and I applaud them for their efforts, but a lot of people choose to self-publish. And, you know, I don't know if that reaches the same group that they intend it to when they self-publish.
You know, I understand that a book that is well-received, and if it is self-published, you're lucky to sell 500 copies. That is a lot of work for 500 copies, isn't it?
Yes, but 500 copies is a lot of books as well. I hope that we sell 500 books. I do.
So what's the plan? Now that we have our first little book available and ready to go, what's going to happen next? Are we going to write another one? Are we going to write part two of A Mushroom's Dream? Are we going to tell the story of Bodie or Reagan or one of the other little dogs out in the kennel?
I think if part two is in the future, it's going to take you and Nicole doing a whole lot more mushing.
A whole lot more mushing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll see about that. But I just wanted to talk today about the process. I know a lot of people out there saying that's on their bucket list, to write a book one day. And like I always say, never forget your dreams. Go out there and do it. Take the time. Do it right. And for any advice I can give, make sure you edit, and reread 100 times.
Absolutely. But, you know, if writing a book is on your bucket list, And all you've got is a piece of notebook paper. I mean, I had a computer, but I really did jot it down on a piece of notebook paper. Start right there. If you can start right there and you can get through the thought process of writing it out in the notebook, reread it, and then have a friend of yours read it, and that's how you start the editing process.
And go back and forth. And do not be...
Right. Don't be afraid of the criticism. Constructive criticism is difficult for me personally to deal with, and it can be hard. The story was completely my little baby idea, but once the final product came out, it's a collaboration. And once you're able to embrace the fact that it's a collaboration of a group of friends that came together for the same end, that's when you can embrace the fact that your little spark of an idea turned into something great.
So you're not thinking novel, autobiography, anything like that in the near future?
I don't know if I could handle it. Seriously, I did have some hard times with the criticism, and I think that people need to be aware of that. A lot of people have trouble with criticism, and they don't recognize that they have that trouble until they put themselves into something like this.
You mentioned criticism. Of course, when people begin to buy and review your book, what do you think about that? Because, of course, if you do sell it on a site like Amazon or Barnes & Noble or anything like that, you're going to get those reviews, positive and negative. How much of that do you take with a grain of salt, and how much can you use for the future? Because obviously your book is already done, so there's not a way to go edit it. As if somebody criticizes you for, you know, some other type of work, whether it be your blog site or something, you can go in and fix grammatical errors or tweak it here and there. But in a book that's already published and already ready to go, how do you deal with that criticism that is going to come?
You know, that's what I was trying to get at. I think because I'm proud of what the book is and what it's representing in its end product, that whatever the criticism is from this point forward is okay, because part of the process is completing it in the first place.
It is, and it was sometimes a painful process in our part, because we did talk about dogs that passed away and the legacy of Team Ineke and that whole story that so many people know that follow us on all of this media that we do. Sometimes that process was harder than the reward sometimes.
Not for me so much. I think for you it was harder to discuss the parts of the story that deal with the legacy of Ineke. But I think that we captured the legacy in a way that the book is not sad by any means, and the book does not speak about death. So if you're concerned about that for your children, that is not what the book is about.
So for anybody that listens to this show today, if you go on over to our Facebook page at Dog Works Radio and tell us the name of our book and where you heard about it, we'll make sure that we send you out a free copy. So tell us what you know about our little book and how it came to fruition, and we'll make sure that we get out the first person that gives the right response. Head on over to our Facebook page at Dog Works Radio. It will be up and rolling here in just a few minutes. This show was going to air live at 5 o'clock Alaska time. So I'm sure we'll have a winner very soon. So if you would like a copy of our little book, head on over to our Facebook page and let us know. What else is on tap, Michelle? We have about 5 minutes left. In terms of the mushing world, what else is happening?
Well, lots of training going on out there, so everybody out there on the roads, please be aware. There are some areas on the Parks Highway where mushers run fairly close to the road. Also, I would like to mention that if you see a dog team out there and the musher looks like they need some assistance, just stop your car and ask. Don't just jump in and give assistance.
You know, that's interesting. We heard on our email list last night that there was a musherless team of four dogs and a loose dog that was trailing behind, and that was at 7 or 8 o'clock last night. And we got an email message sometime around lunchtime that the team was still out there. But my question is, where in the heck is the musher? And the first thought that that went through my head this afternoon when I got the second email is, what if that person had a heart attack or something out there on the trail, and that person's gone, and they, you know, because typically a team does not run for that long without the musher.
That's right, and that was my first concern too, is where's the musher? Are they hurt? Has something happened to them worse than being hurt? It's a great concern of ours up in the Willow area, and I'm hopeful that that dog team did get found and that they're all okay, because a dog team connected to a sled on a gang line, even if it's just four dogs, that's 8 feet of rope, and that has a lot of potential to get wrapped around trees.
It is, and I'm surprised that they were still out and about after that long. It seems to me that those dogs would somehow to come to a stop in that. I just don't understand how they could still be free after 15 hours or so of running.
We are reporting on information, probably sixth or seventh wheel information. So I hope that whoever is giving our email listserv person the information gets them good and correct information, because part of this is that I'm not sure what's going on with this. We've never had a musherless team, or for that matter, a missing sled dog be missing this long without somebody saying something.
Yes, the team in particular. I understand the dogs get lost all the time. They slip their harness or somehow get spooked and break away from the team, but an entire team with a sled, from my understanding, and a loose dog running behind without a musher in sight is a thing that I haven't heard about in a long time. So, Michelle, we're just about out of time, and in the coming weeks, we're going to talk about a couple of topics that that people have been asking about. What we're going to do in the near future is tell what we're going to talk about in the coming weeks. Next week, we are going to talk about what's happening with the different apps out there on our iPhones and smartphones and ways that we track how we're doing out on the trail. Some people still use the old pencil and paper method, the old Roland Lombard method, where they keep notebook after notebook. Some of us use apps on our iPhones. Some of us use GPSs. Some of us use spot trackers. We're going to talk about what we have found is the best way to track our training miles and hours and logs that we do. And then in a couple of weeks, we're trying to schedule a talk with Nils Hahn, who is out in Nome, and he's talking about right to mush. What can you tell us about that, Michelle? I know you sat in on a talk about it at the Willow Dog Mushers. What's going on with that?
You know, the right to mush is an awesome thing that they're trying to initiate here in Alaska that basically says that we have the right to mush on the trails that have been established by us and are used by us and other people as well, but we have the right to those trails and to use those trails. Another thing that I'd like to bring up on that same course is that there is a Department of Forestry meeting coming up, and if you're a musher or if you're a trail enthusiast and you get out there and you use the trail, you should come to that meeting. It's at the Menard Center in Wasilla, I believe the 21st or 22nd. But When you participate in some of these meetings that aren't quote-unquote musher-related, snow machine-related, club-related, but you go outside of that and you participate in some of the meetings for the state, in other words, the Department of Forestry, then you discover what trails have been left out there by the logging companies that are maintained and plowed and how you can get the berms from being too high, so when you come up off of one trail and you're going to cross a road and go down another one, the berms can get so high that you can't get your team over them in certain spots on the trails out there. And that's when you can let the Department of Forestry know, hey, I'm on that trail. Can we have them not do the berm so high in that one spot? And it's amazing how they do make the adjustments. Former president of the Willow Dog Mushers Association is a sitting board member now for the Department of Forestry, and I was very pleased to hear that she sits on that board because she has a lot of influence and a lot of communication between them and the Willow Dog Mushers Association and the other dog mushing clubs, and that's Aaron McLarnon.
So with that, Michelle, of course, we are listened to by folks all over the country and many parts of the world. So, of course, we focus on a lot of what's happening in Alaska and in our neck of the woods, obviously, because we know about it. So we're also going to talk about in the coming weeks about some of the Iditarod rules. And the reason we're going to talk about some of the Iditarod rules is because many of those rules are used in the smaller races as a guideline and as a way to manage their races as well. So we're going to talk about some of those rules in the coming future about how they impact mushing and the sport of it and how a race is conducted. Michelle, what else? We have about a minute.
Right to Mush does have a Facebook page. I encourage people to go out there and like the page and learn more about the information that's being put out there about Right to Mush.
So next week we're going to talk about tracking your runs. I'm looking forward to that. I have quite a bit of experience on that using several different things. So that will be an interesting show. Then after that, we'll move forward into the mushing season.
That's right.
So we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.